As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I am JJ Bull. Joe Devine is not here this week, but even better, people are here, like Seb Stafford Bloor.
Hello, JJ Bull.
You sound very sexy today, Seb, with your nice low voice.
Thank you very much. Sorry, we'll see if my throat can withstand the podcast, see if it can survive for the next hour.
Withstand the sheer power of the podcast. And also...
the podcast.
Yes, and yes, we're in various states of play here. And also we're joined by Alex Stewart.
Hello, JJ.
Alex sitting in his stairwell today. We've decided to do this over Zoom for various reasons, one of them being a bank holiday. And I spent all of yesterday in a brewery. Today's show is going to be very good. We watched lots of football this weekend, and it was all phenomenal. Like, there was Newcastle, they played, Liverpool played. The title race gets ever faster, which is obviously good. That's what you want. Very exciting. Down at the bottom as well, Watford and Burnley. Ooh, what a game. There was also a game in another country that I know me and Seb watched. We'll find out if Alex watched it later. But if you like football from all different countries, well, the best way to read about those is by going to The Athletic. And if you go to theathletic.com/TIFO, I think is the link, there'll be a deal. And you should take that deal now. And in exchange for your clickering on the link, you will get something like 30 days for free. And it's a trial. You have to try it out. Try it for yourself. See if you like it. And if you do, oh boy, you're going to be in for a real, real good time because you get to read all the great things. What's the best thing you've read in The Athletic this last week, Seb?
Well, JJ, I read a really, really excellent obituary of Mino Raiola by James Horncastle. All about how he rose to become one of the most influential agents the game has ever seen. Really excellent. Also, bust a few myths about his career. Very, very interesting read, which came out this morning, which is Monday. So, yeah, do have a go at that. And if you're on your trial while you read that, then you will definitely be, what's the opposite of trial? Becoming a permanent member, not trial member.
Yes, be a member of the club of which everyone wants you to be a member.
Forever. Yeah, exactly.
But it, like we say, it is a trial. It doesn't have to be forever. But if you do it forever, you'll have a great time. Anyway, that's our Athletic plug this week. So I think what we should do is talk about the football, because we should do that. So without further ado, what's he say? I'll leave you in the cold arms.
Warm embrace.
I'll leave you in the cold arms and the
warm heart.
The warm heart and the wonderful voice. Look at Seb's voice this week of Seb Stafford Bloor and Alex Stewart. Newcastle 0-1 Liverpool. They keep their grip on the, well, second place, isn't it? Because they're in second after this weekend. Manchester City are still on top. What happened in this? Why should we talk about this one?
Well, I think Alex should talk about this one because I did not watch it. We were on the way back from our TIFO retreat when this happened.
Oh, yes.
I don't know what the TIFO retreat is because I obviously wasn't invited because I've already retreated enough from the world and I don't need to be encouraged any further. I read a really nice book actually over the weekend called A Simpler Life from the School of Life Publishing House. You should read it. Everyone should read it. The reason that this is interesting, I think, is mostly just because Liverpool are really purring despite the fact that they made, I think, 5 changes for this game. So Joe Gomez came in at right back. It was a really interesting point on Match of the Day about how they were still able to maintain this high defensive line, spring a number of offside traps, possibly the most offsides that have been recorded in a game this season by a team, I think, I vaguely recall.
I think it was 9 against Newcastle, and that was the record this season because it's normally 8 they get, but they're very good at that, yeah.
Yeah, there was one particular point where Gomez was quite a little bit behind play, but was able to adjust rapidly and step up. Milner obviously slotted in. Naby Keita, who has been having something of a resurgence, is kind of an interesting player, Naby Keita, because he was a stats darling when he moved to Liverpool, and everyone was hugely excited about him, and he did all kinds of sexy things like press-resistant dribbling, which us stats nerds like to get excited about. But obviously he's not quite delivered on that promise, largely because of injury, but these last few weeks, I think we've seen him be really dominant in Liverpool's midfield, add something in terms of progression, in terms of driving forwards. Obviously, he got a great goal. But yeah, it's mainly just this, you know, Liverpool are rotating. We've associated Liverpool with this front three, particularly for such a long time. And in this game, Luis Diaz came in, Diogo Jota came in, and they're still just clicking. They should have won this game by more, but it's really impressive. And obviously, with Klopp announcing that he is in fact staying, that the sabbatical is no more. This is a team, I think, you know, we're going to see a two-horse race in the Premier League for the next 4 or 5 years for sure. Is that going to be exciting? Who can say?
I think so. And I don't think it'll be like in Scotland where the two are just so far ahead you can't get close. Or, I mean, I suppose in Spain you've got 3 really. Atletico are kind of in the mix. That on that offside point, I think this is one of the things that when it goes wrong, pundits immediately say, well, they should have been playing a different way. But there seems to be a universal acceptance of what they're doing is actually working very well. Like pushing high and deliberately trying to catch people offside. It's the high risk bit of it. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of times you'd find people would slag that off and say that they're idiots for trying it.
Yeah. I mean, I think I go back to a game that Spurs absolutely eviscerated Southampton. Seb will remember this game. I think Song Heung-min set up Harry Kane for 4 goals or something obscene. And their Saints were committed to this incredibly high line, very energetic, kind of trying to press in the middle of the park. And they got absolutely pulled apart. But when it works, obviously, both from a defensive perspective in terms of denying the opposition space to build up, catching the opposition offside, but also in an offensive way, because you are compressing the space, it allows you to turn the ball over higher up the pitch and therefore, you know, create opportunities off the back of that. It's really effective. Liverpool also have Alisson in goal who, you know, made at least, I think, one. There was one very good one-on-one save when it was actually offside anyway. But he has this ability to kind of command the area in much the same way as Edison does. He's good enough with his feet. That is part of what allows them to do this. Van Dijk's recovery pace, Matip's recovery pace as well is really helpful, but it's absolutely crucial to what Liverpool do. And yes, like you say, pundits will pick up on the 1 or 2 times that it goes wrong because everyone likes a stick to beat teams with.
Do you know what I was thinking? In this Liverpool Man City teams, right? So Seb, we're going to do this a Premier League team of the season soon, right? This is the thing we're going to do. And I was thinking about who maybe we get into mind. All of the players come from Man City and Liverpool. The best ones are all at those two clubs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it kind of makes a statement about the league, doesn't it? I think also what's quite interesting about that is that, I suppose the same is really true of Man City, but certainly at Liverpool, all the best players in the league, all the players that you can think of that have had standout seasons, in that side, they've kind of had standout seasons at different times. So you had that ridiculous purple patch that Mohamed Salah had, and then he tailed off a little bit, so he went from being absolutely outstanding to merely very excellent, and then Sadio Mane's level rose. And then Naby Keita started to show what a good player he is. Like Alex mentioned it before about how he was perceived in Germany. And you're kind of suddenly now seeing the player that he was assumed to be. Luis Diaz came in January and was immediately excellent. And I think the same is really true at Man City. I think Gabriel Jesus's renaissance kind of he's just rehabilitated his reputation a little bit. I don't think he was thought of badly. He was just a kind of an afterthought. Bernardo Silva has sort of come into his own over the probably since the beginning of the new year, and Kevin De Bruyne's form. And so all you have is kind of like these rising thermals that come out of different parts of the team, sort of different pockets of space on the side. And as a result, the level never really drops. And the result is these two teams that just batter everybody continuously every week. And yeah, it's interesting. It's also, we were doing JJR Player of the Season vote last week on the live stream. It makes things like that really difficult.
Live on the stream
with some technical difficulties, but they were resolved. And it makes that kind of thing really difficult because obviously recency bias becomes a huge, huge, huge factor. Even if kind of a player's had an excellent 2 weeks, you're thinking, ah, yeah, but, you know, Mohamed Salah was only really brilliant for 6 months and, you know, he was only an 8 out of 10 last week, so we'll just drop him off the ballot. But it's, I don't know, it's at the same time both an incredibly depressing indictment of Premier League football because it's just dominated by a small group of players, but also it's also a very flattering description of the two squads that have been put together and the talent within them.
But there's also, right, this is another thing I think, this is probably a stupid thing to say, that sometimes you look at a team and they're losing and you think, those players are rubbish. Like Newcastle's players, for example, right? So you think, they're not very good. They're not very good, and you think they're not very good. But then they're playing for, they do well. You suddenly see that there's good, I'm trying to think of a good team like this as an example, is like Everton. So I don't think their squad's very good at all. It's pretty poor. But if they were to win, say, 6 games in a row, you start to see, oh, Richarlison's really, really good. Calvert-Lewin's a really good player. Michael Keane, it was highly thought of not that long ago. I don't really know what my point is here, but...
It's context. Your point is about context, though, isn't it? Because like if you raise the baseline of a team, like if everybody is pretty good, you get to see the kind of the outstanding performance. Like the Everton point's spot on because you see... You only really see how good Richarlison is when there's a kind of system in place which allows him to perform really well. When there's too much responsibility on him, when he's kind of the system itself rather than an extension of it, you kind of see limitations and you see him missing chances and you see him a little bit frantic in his movement. So no, it's a very, very fair point. I think Wolves are a pretty good example of that. Or they were at different points under Nuno Espirito Santo and, you know, for most of this season under Bruno Lage. Like, when they're playing well, people talk about... I know he's had an injury disrupted sort of 18 months, but people talk about how good a player Pedro Neto is. And we haven't mentioned Pedro Neto, really, for ages. Part of that's injury, but part of it's because Wolves has kind of dropped off since the turn of the year. So you need... Yeah, you need that baseline for kind of your standout performance to operate from.
Alex... Did you vote for someone in the Football Writers Award this season?
No, because I'm not a member of the FWA.
Ah, I did not know that. Well, I thought it was interesting. We talked about this in the live stream. That me and Seb did, like Seb was saying, picked our player on the deadline, which is the 27th of April, I think it was. I always think this is very interesting because if you don't live in journalist land, this is how it's decided. It's people like the ones on this podcast right now, except Alex, who make these votes. And then that becomes... And one of the things that me and Seb were talking about that I thought was interesting was that, as well as recency bias being a thing, within like media and newspapers and whatever we refer to The Athletic as, there's some sort of thing where we create, or not us, but other people create a sort of narrative that then makes this player seem better than he is. I think... N'Golo Kanté was one of the best players in the world a couple of seasons ago. Maybe he's dipped down a little bit. But that sort of thing, like, he became the sort of the darling of the stories. It made him the part of that Leicester team that was massive. Who actually won it? Was it Riyad Mahrez or Jamie Vardy or something like that? I can't remember who won the award.
It was Jamie Vardy.
I don't know. I just find that really interesting.
Well, there's always a thing about goals, isn't there? I mean, attacking players are always privileged in this sort of competition. And that's understandable because goals win games... And winning games wins titles. But I do think it's interesting how, probably because of an increase in the availability of tactical analysis in the media and also stats, I think people maybe are recognizing the contributions of players who are not just the Mohamed Salah or the Jamie Vardy or the Song Heung-min or Harry Kane. Like, maybe people are a little more appreciative of that kind of player. That perhaps reached its apogee fairly or unfairly with Jorginho being touted to win the Ballon d'Or, which no. But I do think there's probably an increased awareness of the fact that it's not just players that score goals. I mean, I'd be interested to know who you both voted for? Are you allowed to tell me?
Goals win games. Mohamed Salah.
Yeah, I voted for Salah too. Like, there's a really interesting point there, like the Vardy thing. The Vardy thing was about two things, in my opinion. One, he became emblematic of that title win because so many of the victorious moments within that season involved him scoring goals. He went on that incredible run of consecutive games scoring goals. Also, he came with that prepackaged story about his rise from the lower leagues. And that's always very, very seductive, especially for football writers who try and kind of, you know, add additional layers to stories.
I'm not saying that it shouldn't have been him. I think it's an interesting wider point about how that conversation's moved on a bit.
Yeah, I wasn't a member of the FWA until after that season. But I think also the N'Golo Kanté thing is quite interesting because I think a lot of this comes in hindsight. Like, I think most people knew probably halfway through that Leicester season when it became realistic that they might win the title and everyone started talking about Kanté, but it wasn't the kind of, right, we're going to talk about him from August onwards. And also, I think what he's achieved in the years since, obviously European Cup winner, he's won the Premier League, he's worked under a succession of managers, and also he's become accepted as being world-class because it's not just a single season, whereas other players within that, so Danny Drinkwater has never been the same player again. He was a system footballer. Robert Huth, Wes Morgan, Danny Simpson, these players, Christian Fuchs, Shinji Okagawa is the Armenia Bielefeld player. Okazaki, like, it was a strange collection of footballers who achieved an incredible level together. And Kanté, like Mahrez, like Vardy at the time, they've been the ones to separate themselves in the years since. And so I think that becomes it's very difficult actually to vote for something within a single season. When someone says, who's your footballer of the year? It's impossible when you think of someone like Mohamed Salah not to factor in what he's done before and not to think of the goals, because a lot of his goals look similar to one another. He's, you know, his patterns of play are quite familiar. And so isolating something in time, creating kind of a vacuum of judgment is super hard. So, it's fair enough.
As I've said before, I think ultimately these sorts of things are completely pointless for the reasons that you've just described.
That is a very broad area of stuff that you just don't rate as being important though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true as well.
It's a lot of things in that category.
Individual awards don't matter until you win one. That's basically how that works.
Yeah, exactly that.
Okay, let's talk about a different game then. Watford 1-2 Burnley. Very exciting stuff at the bottom of the table. Aston Villa beat Norwich. Norwich are down. That's one thing. We can talk about that in a bit. But Watford here, they took the lead, didn't they? And then Burnley came back. Am I correct in thinking that?
You are indeed correct in thinking that. So Burnley went behind to a James Tarkowski own goal. Really unlucky one. It's not like a sort of a Jamie Pollock own goal. It was just a deflection. And he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I was really impressed by... I think Burnley have become a lot more intense. I think the key to that their comeback on Saturday was the fact that for long periods of that game, particularly the second half, Watford found it really difficult to get out of their own half. And when you're a struggling side that have conceded lots of goals and probably lack a lot of confidence in your defensive positions, if you're being asked to do a lot of things in your own penalty box, not a good thing. Having said that, I do think it was a case of Burnley winning the game rather than Watford losing it. Ben Foster had made a couple of really, really good saves to keep them ahead, but then ultimately super, not really diving header by Jack Cook, more a kind of, falling, collapsing header. Because you know how your classic diving header is a bit more sort of, has a little bit more of a straighter trajectory. He kind of just, it almost looks like he trips over into the ball and sort of faces it into the net. It's actually technically a very good finish and a great bit of movement actually by Jack Cork. And 1-1 and then it becomes 2-1 with Josh Brownhill winning it. It's interesting because I think sort of that was an example. And, after Everton won on Sunday, that this might not quite hold up as much as it did. But you win a game like that, two goals in quick succession, all your substitutes and coaching staff kind of pile out of the dugout to celebrate. And that looked like a survival moment from Burnley. You know, when on like Premier League years, they play decisive fixtures and you show the response to the crowd and the kind of the moments that define the season. That looked like one of them. And I still think it will, because there was a huge win for Burnley because, yes, I know, and I'm sure we'll talk about Everton later, but the table still says that Everton are a huge amount of trouble. And Burnley are looking pretty good. They've got a not such a bad run in. So yeah, it was good. It was. I was thinking back to what we said in the aftermath of Sean Dyche being sacked, and I think two things can be true. I think that you could say that the way that Sean Dyche was handled was pretty brutal, given what he's done for the club. But now it looks like the right decision because there's an energy there, an intensity, and there's a kind of, I hope this doesn't sound derogatory, but there's a simplicity to the football, which is very effective, I thought. Anyway, maybe Burnley fans want to correct me on that one, but it's become a little less complicated and it's becoming more effective as a result. Like, you're seeing the reappearance of what you probably consider more traditional Burnley values in their football, and that's been the heart of their kind of revival, I think. But yeah, huge win.
Well, is there anything tactically different that's changed since Dyche has gone, or is it just that sort of the cliched new manager bounce, even though it's not a new manager, and a bit of a wake up from losing someone like Dyche?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Dwight McNeil is playing off the right hand side to start with a lot more, although towards the end of this game, or maybe the final third, he swapped back with Aaron Lennon, who I thought actually had a really good game. Aaron Lennon, which kind of,
oh my god, he still plays,
confused me. Yeah, and so you have this you know, McNeil's obviously is very capable of driving with the ball. He's also part of what Seb is saying, this ability to press high and actually regain possession. McNeil does that really effectively, which is not something you necessarily associate with him. But those surging runs coming in off the right-hand side onto a stronger left foot, that makes a lot of sense. Although there is also an argument to say if you're playing Veghorst up front, then you should have orthodox wingers to cross the ball in. I think what Seb's saying about simplicity is true to a degree. They're working the ball a little bit more patiently, and they're a little bit better at creating, you know, third man runs, passing opportunities out of triangles. It's slightly more measured, and I think that's been really successful. Also, you know, someone like Vidra dropping off, adding a little bit of possession in that kind of 10 space, because obviously if Burnley are playing with that 4-4-2, that's an area that they tend not to occupy all that much. So yeah, like, little changes, nothing massively significant, but significant enough to be working.
Well, I mean, it looks very much like Watford are gone. It's not mathematically correct yet. They're 10 points off Everton, who have a game in hand, at the 19th. They've only got 1 point more than Norwich, just to put in context how bad they've been this season. But they're gone. Yeah, they're gone. They're gone. Well, let's talk about another game after this break.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And we're back from the break. What a break we had there. Now, Norwich are gone. I don't really care about that game. Aston Villa won that 2-0. Well done to them. But what we should talk about is Everton 1-0 Chelsea, to say it in proper Tifo language. So Everton managed to beat Chelsea. I watched this in the brewery that I was in yesterday, and the general consensus was that Chelsea were doing Lampard a favour, which is obviously not what they were doing. That's not what happened. How did Everton beat Chelsea?
They worked incredibly hard. I know that's going to sound like a proper football man thing to say. They wanted it more.
It's always the answer to that, isn't it?
But they did, actually, to be fair. The lineup, going off the team sheet, it looked like it would be a pretty orthodox 4-3-3, which is something that Lampard likes, with Iwobi on the right-hand side of that midfield. But I don't know whether they started immediately, because I was making a coffee, I'm sorry. But the shape very, very quickly looked like a 5-4-1. But it was an interesting 5-4-1, because with Coleman as the right-sided centre-back, and also Holgate as the left-sided centre-back, who has played as a full-back, although not on the left-hand side, you had really aggressive wide centre-backs from Everton, who were pushing out and being really quite disruptive, with Yerry Mina kind of anchoring as a sweeper. And that meant that when Chelsea were trying to drop off and have players like Werner or Mount or Havertz playing between the lines, one of those centre-backs would push up and create problems for them, often helped out by a midfielder dropping back. It also meant that one of those wide centre-backs could pull wide and double up with a full-back or wing-back if, again, Werner or Havertz pulled out into the wide areas, or if Chelsea tried to create overloads with their wing-backs. So it was like a really good defensive system. It made a lot of sense. It also relied on huge work ethic. I mean, Damari Gray's running, tackling, trying to do everything and then carry the ball forwards for Richarlison. If you're a fan of a team that is in that much trouble and you have a player like Damari Gray putting in that kind of effort, like, you feel good about that. I thought he was absolutely superb. But yeah, it was just good. It was hardworking, and it was a nice contrast from the Merseyside derby, which was a game that I really enjoyed watching. But Everton, this felt like an Everton team that was defensively organised, gritty and aggressive, without that little bit of sort of histrionics and time-wasting and so on that characterised the Merseyside derby. It was like Lampard had taken it all the way to 11 in terms of, you know, getting his team to play like dicks, and then dialed it down to maybe a 9 against Chelsea, and it worked really effectively.
That's what I noticed was how, I think it's written down here, but I agree, spiky Everton have been. It's like, that's what Lampard seems to have done, is get them fired up. So
yeah, that spikiness, that needle kind of came out of nowhere in that game though, didn't it? Because all of a sudden there was that strange running battle between Yerry Mina and Kai Havertz, which seemed to last about 75 minutes. Also, there was a strange moment where I felt like Cesar Azpilicueta sensed that his teammates were a little bit sleepy for the main. And it was kind of, Chelsea are in that weird territory where their season's over, they're going to finish in the Champions League places, they've got nothing really left to play for. And Azpilicueta kind of involved himself in a ruck just before, I think it was just before half time, that sort of, it was like a kind of, look at me lads, I'm up for it, everybody else wake up a little bit moment. But yeah, it became nasty at different points. There was that sort of feigned headbutt that Mina tried on Havertz. Didn't know you were allowed to do that, I'd be honest, but okay. Kind of headbutt feint. But it's important, because I think if Everton play that Chelsea side with a kind of dispassionate, purely tactical approach, they're going to lose because they're inferior. Whereas if you turn it into something which is a little bit beyond football, and where the kind of the atmosphere and the mood gets a little bit more jagged, I think you have a better chance. And also that suited the way that Everton wanted to play. So Alex has talked about Damari Gray, absolutely right. He was really, really excellent. Richarlison was brilliant. Richarlison was the kind of, I think as Everton have sunk more into the depths, you've seen the kind of the more blue-collared side of Richarlison's playing personality. He's worked very, very hard. There was a time during the second half when he went down like about 4 or 5 times with what looked like a really nasty cramp. He kept getting up and hobbling around. But if you want to play intensely, and if you want to play in a combative way, hey, keep the adrenaline up in the game. It suits you. And also, let's not turn kind of Yerry Mina into just a bogeyman player. Like, I thought he played very, very well. And also, he makes a huge difference to them. Just him being there, I don't think he's the very best defender. He's not the most reliable, but when he's good, he's very good. And also, he very clearly has a kind of talismanic effect on his teammates. And he's clearly well-liked in that group. And these things are super important. And Everton were good.
You could see that. You could see that dynamic between him and Pickford.
Yeah, for sure.
Made 3 really good saves. Yeah. The first one where he scrambles back across the goal once the ball's hit the post was an outstanding piece of goalkeeping. But I thought that point you were making, Seb, about Needle was absolutely right. And what felt really interesting was that Everton's aggression and caring felt entirely genuine.
Yeah.
Whereas Chelsea seemed to have to try to manufacture that. It was like they started the game just not really being up for it, which, can't believe I'm saying that.
No, but it's the right thing to say, though, because I think at the highest level, there's like a kind of a 5% difference between application and attitude. It makes a huge difference. And also, Chelsea are kind of in a little bit of an undead state, though, aren't they? Because they were absolutely dreadful against Arsenal 10 days ago in that game at Stamford Bridge, defended dismally. They beat West Ham, but I think West Ham well, you know, took them all the way at Stamford Bridge at the last weekend. And this was another, they had a lot of possession. They didn't really do anything with it. You know, Pickford did make a couple of good saves, but they were very, very muted.
If I were a Chelsea fan, I would be so frustrated with the fact that they are constantly overlooking runs in behind all the time.
They recycle
the ball, they shift it out wide, they create these patterns, but there were, I think, four or five occasions at least that I counted where there was a, not simple, but there was a direct progressive pass through the lines to a player that was making a good run, often Werner, actually, and Chelsea are just ignoring it. I don't know whether there's reticence because so many chances have been spurned, or because the tactical instructions are so clear that, you know, you get it wide, you pull them this way, you pull them that way. But, like, just play the ball in behind occasionally. Because
I think it's comfort zone football, Alex. Honestly, I think it's just there's no real need for incision. There's no urgency about it. It's just, it's easier just to play the ball inside, play your passes neat, play it tidy. You're not responsible for anything. You're not to blame for anything. I think it's kind of human nature in their situation. Ownership is a mess. There has to be major surgery on some of those departments. A lot of those players, not quite sure about their futures, I would say. And it's just, this is what happens at the end of the season. This kind of zombie teams you get sort of from about April onwards, and Chelsea are that side at the moment, I think.
So another thing I would say, at the end of the season, like you're saying, these sort of zombie teams, Chelsea know they're going to finish basically third or fourth, so they're not going to win anything else. So the motivation is going to be slightly less. Whereas Everton players have probably realised, looking at the table, they're running out of games, and they genuinely could. I mean, it's felt for so long that they can't go down. They're Everton, you know, it's like Newcastle was before, but they actually can. They really can. They're very close to it. Another game where you tend to get a lot of motivation with players who just go nuts at each other is the Old Firm, Rangers versus Celtic. And Celtic played Rangers this weekend, and the score finished 1-1. Celtic 1-1 Rangers. People always ask me to talk about these Old Firm games when they're on. I don't care about the Old Firm. I don't care. I don't like it. I think it is annoying that everyone assumes you support one of those two teams. We don't. Not all Scottish people support one of those two teams. It's better when you don't. But annoyingly, I've started to find these games really fun to watch, especially this season. This is the 19th meeting between the two games. I asked Seb to watch this one. What do you think of the game? One of the things I thought was interesting that you said to me is that you didn't know who any of the players were. I mean, you did, but, you know, there's so many new names, which is interesting to me because it seems so, I'm so, you know, familiar with it.
Yeah, I was actually, I wanted to come on and slag off Rangers and Celtic, but I really enjoyed it. I thought the standard of the football was really good, actually. The one thing I will say, though, is that you have these, and I don't know if this is typical of old-firm games. I don't, in the past, I've tended to watch sort of 30-minute snippets of them before, you know, the English football starts somewhere else. Because it usually kind of starts at 12 o'clock and you sometimes get a 1 o'clock kickoff in England. The football was really good. The only thing I'd say is that every now and again you get really good phases of play between really talented players interrupted by less talented players. It's like sometimes they get in the way a little bit. And that's not a dig at either of the sides. It seems common between them. So for instance, I think I said to you when we were WhatsApping, I'm not a huge fan of Jota. I think he's quite a good player, but he played really well on Sunday, so maybe I've got him wrong. But I thought some of the ball progression was good. I thought the rhythm of the game was really fun. There was an intensity to it, and I think it reminded me a little bit of watching Fenerbahce Galatasaray, for instance. Like, it doesn't matter what the situation is in those games, or what the table says, or, you know, what the weather's like. You always get a level of intensity that you feel kind of ratcheting up throughout the game, and that's what keeps your attention. But in this instance, it wasn't just like, you know, massive vending machine-shaped players slamming into each other for 90 minutes. It was just, the football's good. And they seem really well-matched teams as well, which is super important. But for me, because I grew up in a kind of a different era of the Old Firm derby when, like, that game was full of world-class players, like, full of them. I'm thinking about back to the kind of the 90s, like, you could turn on that game and you'd see like Van Hooijdonk or Larsen or Laudrup or Gaskell and a Gordon Jury. You know, like, it was the equal of anything you could find in England. In fact, you could argue that I would say that some of those teams would have been pretty competitive in the Premier League at the time because they were pretty developed and, yeah, full of talent. So it's not quite as it was, I understand, but I had a fun time. And anytime you give me like competitive football in a really good atmosphere, I'm kind of sold. I don't need anything more than that.
What do you think of the Old Firm games, Alex? Is there something that interests you?
I don't know. I've not really watched one. I mean, I can echo what Seb says. My memory of Old Firm games is from an earlier period. And so, yes, I associate, I don't, even like Van Bronckhorst, for example, playing as a left back at Rangers. I don't know. I think, yes, there's passion is good, I guess.
You hate passion. You hate it.
No, I don't hate passion. I suppose you want those games to be competitive from a footballing perspective. You don't want them to be exciting because everybody's shouting a lot, you know? Like there needs to be something to it. And they're both clearly interesting sides tactically at the moment, so I suspect it would have been a good game. I'm very pleased that you enjoyed it.
The football was good though. Like both the goals were really well constructed. The second goal especially, and that's a lovely move that leads to. I did enjoy how much they all hate Joe Hart though. Like because for the second goal, ball just gets lashed past him at like 400 miles an hour at near post. Oh, he's been in his near post. It's rubbish. I just hate him for being English. There's going to be no lonelier place in world football than being an English goalkeeper in the Old Firm derby. It's got to be a terrible decision. But yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it. And yeah, Rangers probably should have won it with that one that came off the post at the end by Fashion Junior. What's his surname?
Sakala.
Yeah, good plan. Good plan. Fashion Sakala is a great name for a footballer.
It's decent football. He's all right, yeah. Well, that's that game. Let's have a little break and we'll come back because Seb has to go.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And we're back, and Seb has gone. He's a busy boy. I was going to mention, actually, I forgot to talk about this on the Old Firm bit. This was a particularly... So you associate it with being all like fire and steel and swords. But here, it was actually, I think it was pretty tame. I mean, Postecoglou and Van Bronckhorst shared a hug at the end, which is very unlike... these sorts of games tend to be a nice handshake.
Should not be allowed.
And one other thing that annoys me still about Scottish football is that the coverage by the pundit, I think in English football it's got so much better. I think like BT Sports show on Saturdays before the games is like superb. The analysis is amazing. They clearly put lots of work and production into it, and whoever their researchers are work closely with the footballers to produce those little segments they do. And then you've got Monday Night Football, Sky Sports, fantastic stuff. Like really, like when Carragher and Neville are on it, I just love watching that show. It's great. Whereas here, before the Celtic Rangers game, you had Chris Boyd, they were talking about all the Celtic players they had, and they've got these players who can play as strikers. They've got Kyogo, Yakumakis, a couple of them. Abada plays as a winger, and then Jota plays as a winger. But you've got all these guys, and they weren't sure who's going to play up front to the middle. Is it Kyogo? Is it going to be whoever else is on the pitch? And Boyd says, well, can't you play the two together? And like the reason Celtic are good now is they don't play two strikers. It's the system is the most important thing for their resurgence. You can't play two strikers up front to the middle because it changes that lack of... He must know, Chris Boyd, has played international football. He must know that the way that tactics and systems work... I know it's a small part of the game, but it's relevant. It really annoyed me. And I thought I'd dig him out on a podcast. Sorry, Chris Boyd. I'm sure you don't listen to this anyway. Yeah, that's what I have to say in that. It's important, Alex, isn't it? We've made careers out of it.
Yeah, I hope you feel better for expiating yourself in that way. No, but it is, true. Like, there was some stuff around the Villarreal game where pundits, I use that word advisedly, were complaining about Villarreal's style of play being negative. And, you know, that's, it's a disgrace. I was like, it's not a disgrace. It's a team that's not as good trying to beat a team who are better by playing a very clear, well-thought-out and well-constructed system of football. You just don't like it. Stop it.
That particular clip you're referring to as well, because I know the one you mean, that I think a lot of this is just, it's people get in a little flow state with these sorts of things, knowing sort of that it's an easy thing to pick up and go viral.
Oh, I mean, there's sure. a certain point of that. Yeah, but then like...
And I don't resent any of that stuff. I think it's quite funny. I like that sort of... on one hand, I don't like what Chris Boyd's saying. This is bad punditry. But I quite like someone who's got a strong opinion and goes for it. I enjoy that. Yeah,
as long as that opinion is correct.
We can't all be correct, Alex, all the time. Someone who else who can't be correct all the time is David Moyes. West Ham 1-2 Arsenal.
Oh, dear.
What do you make of this one, Alex?
Yeah. I think that it was slightly like watching a headliner when the warm-up band has been absolutely brilliant. And you're a bit like, I know all these songs. You know, it felt like a letdown after the Everton game. Arsenal, we've talked a bit about Arsenal in the past. Like, they're a good side who are getting better, but I find myself respecting what they do rather than being excited by it. When Bukayo Saka gets on the ball, that can be exciting because he's just fun. Like, he did a couple of things in this game that were really enjoyable. I think what Nketiah is doing is interesting. I mean, he had quite a few shots in this game, but he was obviously making an effort to drop off, to link play, to press. You could see
he was dropping really deep and to link.
It was like Arteta's like, I want you to do the stuff that Lacazette was doing, but also because you're younger and faster, I then expect you to get back up into the box and provide some sort of threat as well. And actually, that seems to be working relatively well. He's not going to stay as a starting striker for them if they can afford to buy someone better. But, you know, it was decent. I think, what else did I highlight? Oh, yeah, you've clicked on that Twitter thing that I've helpfully put in the podcast plan about Jared Bowen, which reminds me what I'd actually put. Yeah, Jared Bowen, I mean... 100th goal involvement across league football. He was able to inject some excitement into this game on occasion. There's a directness to him. There's a unpredictability.
He's really like good.
He is fun.
He's such a good player.
And I think in a game where I would absolutely not say that either team was going through the motions at all. I think it was just a game that started at a low tempo and generally failed to ignite. I mean, there was... that bit where Rice and Nketiah got in each other's faces and that seemed to go on for 5 minutes and no one was entirely sure why it was happening. But it felt like a slightly lethargic game peppered with moments of excellence from a couple of exciting young players in Bowen and Saka that was otherwise fairly unremarkable.
Well, we can talk about transfer gossip linked to Arsenal because I quite like this one. Gabriel Jesus has been strongly linked with a move there, possibly in the summer. He would be very good in that Lacazette role, the dropping false nine player. You can come in. He's very good tactically. It would suit Arteta, obviously. He's worked with him. I remember this game, I think he played against Real Madrid, and Guardiola played him as a left-sided forward, almost like a wing-back, because he was coming... So that the positions are sort of dead with Guardiola, I think. It's just you're in certain bits of the pitch, depending on certain phases of play, where the ball is, where your opponent is. But Jesus was one of the most important players in that game. I think they won it, if I recall correctly. Yeah, going up and down that left wing, making sure Danny Carvajal couldn't do anything. And so that's the kind of thing that Arteta would have worked on, and I think he was there at that time. Yeah, that would make so much sense going to Arsenal, right?
It's the tactical intelligence that you're talking about. I think that's one of the things that is underrated, underappreciated, particularly in attacking players. Is the degree to which, because I suppose we associate a lot of the time attacking play and goal scoring is to do with instinct and anticipation and minutiae, and that's not disrespectful at all, but I mean the little moments or movements that take you away from defenders, or the stop-start before you begin your run that allows you to spring in behind and so on and so forth. And so we rightly highlight those aspects when we talk about attacking players because that's what produces goals. But you get some attacking players who are also really smart in terms of how they tactically fit in with the rest of the team. Obviously, if you spent a lot of time working with Guardiola, that's going to be heightened because Guardiola is really good at getting players to do that. And you can see with that Arsenal lineup, particularly if they play that 4-2-3-1 where you've got, you know, I prefer Smith Rowe to Martinelli. I don't quite get the Martinelli thing at this point, but
oh really? Oh, I think Martinelli. I'd have him over everyone that team apart from Saka. I think Martinelli is properly could be one of those top tier players in a few years. Like he's already he makes things happen. So things happen.
I just haven't seen enough of him yet. But I like. But if you've got players like Smith Rowe or Martinelli or Saka who are looking to cut inside, a forward player who will either be in the box or able to drop off and link play creatively or pull wide and create those little moments of space, because the anticipation of how you move to create space for others is so important for Guardiola coach teams and is clearly something that Arteta wants to get his players doing as with as much synchronicity and as fluidly as a Guardiola side, because that's the aspiration for a coach of Arteta's type. He's going to fit really well into that. And, you know, he's young enough to fit in with the age profile of the sort of players that they're looking to recruit, but he's old and experienced enough to actually provide some of that leadership and some of that experience in that part of the pitch, which they are kind of slightly lacking a little bit. So yeah, makes perfect sense.
The players they can get in the summer will depend on the next four games, because they currently sit in fourth, Arsenal, which is seems to be generally regarded as ahead of where they thought they would be or aimed to be. Like the jump this season should have been to get Europa League place, maybe. Man United, who play on Monday night, obviously record this on a Monday, I would expect them to lose to Brentford, weirdly. that's how bad they are tonight now.
Why is that weird? I would expect them to lose to Brentford as well.
Just how the mighty have fallen.
I mean, can you see like Ivan Toney against those Man United centre-backs? It's just funny.
They're not going to like it, yeah. And it's just that's the thing. The confidence has just gone from them. And it's not like they're just desperate to get over the line. Like, you know, they've survived the shipwreck, and then they're just trying to swim to the beach, and they're just so close, and then they can just relax on the beach for a bit, just relax, and then they can work out to build a raft to get home to Manchester. This is a weird journey I've gone down, yeah. But this
also,
is my
Eric Ten Hag's on the beach waving a cocktail, but yes. He's not going to give it to all of them. He's only going to share his cocktail with some players.
That's correct.
Some of them are going,
and he's also got some
back into the sea.
He's got some mates for them already on the beach, ready prepared for his particular survival game. He's built tree huts for them. It's getting bigger. It's sort of like a jungly type
hammocks.
Place. And The Rock is there, and Jack Black, because they're always in those movies, right, on a sort of island
obviously.
Like that.
Jack Black's got an acoustic guitar. So yeah, they'll lose to Brentford. Wahey!
Yeah, there we go. So anyway, that's that. So we just created a sort of adventure movie, and they have to escape from there, having crashed there. But yeah, this is the end of the Premier League season. So like, Tottenham and Arsenal are very much going to be fighting for that bit. I think Spurs' goal difference, this is a stupid thing to say, but Spurs' goal difference of 20 compared to Arsenal's 13 says to me that they are the better team right now and might be able to sneak that in. You can't tell too much on goal difference, but generally when you look at a league and you see that one team's got like plus 40 and they're in similar... Yeah, it tends to mean they're a better team that's scoring more goals, conceding fewer. Man United are going to struggle here. But yeah, Arsenal's signings in the summer will depend largely on where they get that Champions League place, because you can attract better players. That's just the obvious thing. What they definitely need to do is buy in players who are going to get them more goals, because the split in their squad is very, very small. Like, Saka has 11, Smith-Rowe has 10. He's not even started most games. You know, he swaps with Martinelli, not really sure who's there. Odegaard's more a playmaker. And then it's just a bunch of players who have four goals, one of them being Gabriel, who's obviously a centre-back and taking advantage of set pieces. And Ketty has only got two.
Well, both the goals in this game were from centre-backs off set pieces. I mean, Gabriel's was a little developed from that phase.
That's it. Very important set pieces.
It didn't look like anyone else was going to score particularly. Oh, for sure. Set pieces are great, but you don't want to be relying on them to win games like this. I mean, Saka could have scored a bit. Like, there was a really good save from Fabianski, but yeah. They need goals.
They do need goals. And I feel like I've run out of things I want to say about the Premier League this week. Is there any games you've seen that we haven't talked about, Alex?
I watched a little bit of the highlights of Southampton Palace, even. And yeah, Palace, they're quite a sexy team to watch at the moment. There was some really nice link-up play, quick interchanges for a Mateta shot that was saved. Schlupp on the overlap looked really threatening. They've got exciting players there. Southampton are hit and miss team at the best of times, but there's a swagger to what Palace are doing that's really quite exciting. So I enjoyed cameos there, even though it was a defeat of my own side. But yeah, that's it really. Otherwise, just a fairly relaxing weekend. Started rewatching 24.
Oh, that's so good. What season? From season one?
From season one, yeah.
See, I think season two is absolute peak of that whole tour. It's so good. And the problem is, I want to ruin this for everyone, but then like in a later season, I'm allowed to do spoilers now for 24, haven't I? You've seen them all before, have you? Yeah. So there's in like season four or five when the nuclear bomb does actually go off. Like they can't do that because then once that thing is always the threat happens, what are you going to do?
Yeah. But this is what happens with television, is that as a thing is more successful, unless it's been conceived as a start point and end point, people commission a new series. It's like, oh, the last series was so good, everyone loved it. Let's commission a new series. And then things have to become more extreme to hold the audience's attention. And when your starting point is, you know, the potential assassination of a presidential candidate, the only way is to, like, there's not a lot further you can go in terms of stuff getting unbelievably dark. So yeah, they kind of hoist themselves on their own petard. People need to be more disciplined with television series and go, like The Wire, 5 series, in and out, arc that works through the whole thing, no more.
Wait, I mean, it's quite hard to write The Wire, in fairness, but what I would say is, like, once they blew up that bomb in 24, and then that was all, like I said, it's always a threat. Suddenly you don't have that peril that's there, like, that could happen. Once it actually does, then it's not actually that bad. It's like the whole world doesn't end like you think it's supposed to when that goes off. Mm. They sort of ruin the whole point of the show. You need that peril, much like in the Premier League at the bottom, because you've got Everton are just clinging on trying to get in. Leeds got torn apart by Manchester City, sort of. Also a set pieces thing. Man City had a couple of goals from set pieces in that game to get into it. You know, it's not that easy. Leeds look okay. It's very tense at the bottom. And if you imagine this bit with the ding, 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 you know, the 24 bit in the top corner, just as I'm counting down.
That would be a really fun edit to do with the manager's faces.
Yes, yeah. I bet that someone's done that at some point.
If anyone from BT Sport is listening, steal JJ's idea, because he's complimented you and now it's payback time.
Yeah.
In a good way. Payback's a bad thing, isn't it? I mean, it's, yeah. You know,
unless you're paying someone back money you owe them. I am rambling today. I need to stop talking. I think we're going to wrap that up there. Dreadfully sorry, everyone, for my performance in this week's podcast. I swear I'll improve week to week. But yeah, that's the football. It was very good. I'm sure you'll all be pleased to know that Aberdeen won a game finally. But they only scored a goal because of a penalty. Again, this is the only way they can score. In case you were interested in that, I don't think anyone is. But that is our podcast, Alex. Seb's not here for the last part. Maybe it'd have been... If he was here to stop me from rambling, that might have been better. But he wasn't. And we enjoyed ourselves. I had fun. Did you have fun?
Always.
Oh, that's good. Well... Let's do it. Let's end it there. I'm just going to go. I'm going to stop the podcast now. Oh, no, I have to say thanks. Thanks, Alex.
Bye.
Thanks, Seb. Bye, everyone. Have a lovely week.